Welcome to the Team Behind the Team podcast. I am your host, Donnie Mabe. This is the monthly show focused on building conversations around the team-based model approach to athletic performance, strength and conditioning, sports medicine, sports science, mental health and wellness, and sports nutrition. Hello and welcome back to the Team Behind the Team podcast. I'm your host, Donnie Mabe, and we are so fired up and excited. This month, we have a very special guest from right here on the 40 Acres. We'll get to our guests in a minute, but Big Joe, what's going on, brother? How is spring break coming gone? You good?
It's good. Good. Any break is a good break, but it's the dog days of spring. And I'm ready for the championship season to come back in, you know, May, tracks, yeah, end of May, June. So it's coming around the corner. It's coming fast, but yeah, I'm ready. Yeah. I'm ready to get through April, but
any spring break, what did you do? What you going to do over spring break?
Family time.
I love it. I like how you think. I'm shutting it down myself, recharge. So excited about the spring. So anyway, with that, I want to welcome our guest right here from the 40 Acres, Professor Dr. John Daly. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donnie. I'm excited to be here.
Man, I tell you what, for me personally, I love leadership. There is not a greater guy, expert that we could have in the studio today than you, John. So thank you so much for making time. I know you're busy teaching still and all that. So how's the semester been for you?
Semester's great. I just got done teaching, in fact, my undergraduate class. It's called Interpersonal Communication. I did my graduate class right before that. It's called Advocacy. So it's a good semester teaching two of my favorite topics. Interpersonal Communication class is an undergraduate class. It's about relationships and communication and leadership indirectly. And the graduate class MBA is all about how to influence people, persuade people. And so those are two really important things. And I get to teach both of them in the semester. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, I can tell you the listeners to this show are going to be, they're going to get a treat today. Just real quick, short story. When I met John Daly, I was at a Sports Management Institute course through Texas Athletics, and it was multiple days of listening to lecturers and talks. And again, not trying to be mean, but some of them were pretty boring. But when John Daly took the stage and started teaching about leadership, I sat up and like, where is this guy from? I'm like, you are literally one of the best speakers I've ever heard. And I think, John, the thing I love about you, you not only know your content well, but you're very passionate and you love it, and that's infectious. So thank you for what you're doing, and keep doing what you're doing.
I love what I do. I'm amazed to get paid for doing this because it's so much fun anyway. Right. I'm not the golfer, though. When I hear John Daly, most people think I'm
golfer. Yeah, yeah.
Does get me good reservations, though.
It'd be good to have his paycheck, right?
Yes, I have a paycheck. Liquor bill would be too high for me.
Right.
And clothing taste, what can you say? But otherwise.
Right. But to all our listeners, John Daly, just an incredible teacher and lecturer and professor, and had a lot of influence on me as a leader. We're going to get in this topic of advocacy, like you mentioned, and leadership. And this is year 47 at Texas.
Been here a long time. Got here when I was very young.
Did you ever meet Earl Campbell?
I met Earl Campbell. Earl Campbell actually majored in communication at UT, believe it or not.
Did you teach him?
No, but I had many of my colleagues. We had a colleague named Martin Trudero who was his advisor, got him through school at the end. Martin was just a saint to work with Earl on that stuff, but Campbell's degree was in communication, believe it or not.
Yeah, no, I've had the privilege of being around him when I was with football here for years, and he's definitely, he's very well-spoken. So.
He's very well-spoken, he's very good. And we'll take all the credit for it, of course.
Of course, got to take that. So just a little question here to kick us off, like, where did it all begin? We kind of talked about that, but like, what motivated you to become an educator?
I think I always liked watching people work together, talk together, communicate with each other. I was originally attracted to the research, actually. When I went to my master's program, I found research fascinating, discovering things, knowing things, making distinctions that mattered. I found the idea of discovering knowledge the most exciting thing in the world. So after my master's, I better get a PhD. And I got a PhD in communication, and I loved that as well. And I love the idea of helping people and making them more successful by the way they communicate, whether it be in a relationship, whether it be in a job. When you think about communication, it's essential to everything you do in your life. I kind of figured out that's kind of the core thing, that if you don't communicate well, nothing else is going to matter. If you have a great vision, if you can't communicate that vision, if you care about somebody, you can't communicate that caring, it doesn't matter. So I like to say in a classroom, difference between knowing something and teaching it lies in communicating. And it's true in every profession. I mean, doctors. Doctors are effective when they're good communicators. Lawyers are good when they're good communicators. You cannot name a profession where communication doesn't define success. So it's kind of that one thing that makes a difference across every career, across every interest somebody has. Coaches have to be great communicators. Effective players have to be good communicators too on team sports, right? It seems to me a team sport is a communication sport, whether it be verbal or nonverbal sorts of things. But how do you motivate people? You motivate by how you communicate. How do you coach people? It's how you communicate. So I think it's kind of the ultimate kind of hub of everything. That's why I found it so fascinating. And we all do it every day. And the thing is, Nani, you know, fish have no other than water until they're pulled out of water. Right. They go, oh, crap, we're in water. I'm out of water. I need water. We don't know we're in a communication world until we say things we wish we hadn't said. All of a sudden, I can't believe I said that. That's when you become aware of communication. And so because it's so common in our lives, we don't spend much time thinking about how to do it well. Mm-hmm. And I really want to help people get better at communicating their ideas and communicating what their passions, if that makes sense as well.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. I know Joe has seen this, but I mean, even recently, this past year, I've seen some of our athletes struggle and they just don't know how to communicate. And it impacts their performance because, A, to your point, it impacts their relationship with their coach. It impacts their relationship negatively with their teammates. And then because of that, they don't have the result that they're really seeking and they're not as happy and they don't have always a great experience. So, yeah, I mean, especially for – and I think to your point, we're such a digital phone kind of default mode. A lot of our kids are, and they're not very good communicators. They're good with texting and all that, but when they get in front of somebody, they're very intimidated. It's crazy how many athletes today are so intimidated to go talk to their head coach or to fight or advocate for themselves. Yeah. It's interesting.
I think you're right. I think now they do communicate. Don't question them out. Texting is a form of communication. I have an 18-year-old son. I've watched him communicate with his friends. They play a game on the computer and they talk to each other as they're playing. It's a really interesting about how they communicate with technology. But talking still matters. Talking still matters. And one of the basic principles I try to teach everyone is stop negotiating with yourself. Stop making the ask. But people are afraid to make the ask sometimes.
They are.
So an athlete's not willing to make the ask of a coach. Parents not willing to make the ask of a coach. A coach is not willing to make the ask of an AD sometimes. And I say the biggest secret of being successful in life is being willing to make the ask. Too many people negotiate with themselves, it seems to me. So for my MBA class, for example, I give them an assignment. I say, for this semester, once a week, you got to ask for something you know you cannot get.
And they get uncomfortable.
They get comfortable. But I say, look, it's next time you're in an airplane, ask for a better seat automatically. Next time you're in a hotel, ask for a better room automatically.
That's
don't
tough.
Want to ask the question. Next time you're in a restaurant, ask for something on the menu. It's good practice, right? And it's amazing. Many times you'll get it if you make the ask. But people are afraid to make the ask. So if you want, you got to apply. You got to apply for the job. You're not going to get otherwise. So making the ask, right? You got to make the ask for a raise if you want it. You got to ask for the facilities, for the coaching in that sense. Some athletes are wanting to come and say, I need more coaching from you, and they get what they want. Other athletes don't make that ask, and they don't understand why they don't get it. But making the ask is a really important skill people have to develop over time. And a lot of people don't get how important that is until it's too late. Then they say, I wish I had. I should have applied to that school. The example used on the graduate, Donnie, is this. I always say, how many of you did not apply to school because you knew you couldn't get in? People raise their hand. Then how many, somebody in your class who was much stupider applied and got in, right?
Yeah.
So why not make the ask? What's the good to make a mistake in an AU,
that's
right?
That's a good point.
Just make
that's
the
a good
ask.
Point.
And if you don't apply, you're not going to get it. And the same thing operates in any part of your life. If you want that internship, make the ask for the internship. No one's going to choose you otherwise. And that's one of the most important skills. And a lot of people aren't good at that. So I say practice it. I mean, next time I go to McDonald's, ask for something on the menu. They won't do it most of the time, but sometimes they will. Go to a hotel, ask for a better room. They might give you a better room. I guarantee if you don't ask, it's not going to happen, right? So if you get courageous about people you're never going to see again, it gets easier other times too. Mm-hmm. You're married, you got to ask your wife to marry you, okay? Otherwise, not going to happen, okay?
That was a tough ask, too.
Okay, you're tough ask, but you did. I'm sure it was a tough ask. You're scared to death. You'd say no in your case. I'm quite sure.
Don't reject me.
But making the ask is a really important skill, and I'm always amazed by how many people are just afraid to make that ask. And it's career limiting, no question about it.
John, I got to admit, I did a little research on it. I do research on everybody.
Okay, that's
kind of
scary.
And you use an example in a video of asking for a car and had someone in the audience name the price of a Porsche.
Yeah.
So I told Donnie walking in, I was like, Donnie, I've been researching Bentleys all week. So I found a $350,000 Bentley just in case
that's insane.
So
yeah, the example but, I was used is like, yeah. I say to my class, who wants to buy a nice car someday? Yeah. And they'll say, I want to buy a Porsche. Then I'll say, well, how much does a Porsche cost? They say $100,000. So let's suppose you get a bonus in your company. They give you $95,000 in cash in a paper bag. We live in Austin. You're driving home that night. You go right by your neighbored Porsche dealership. There's the car of your dream with 100K in the window. I always say, always go with your paper bag of money. I got $95,000. You want to give me the car for that amount of money? They may not, but they may. But I guarantee if you don't go, and they won't give it to you, right? Yeah. They may have negotiated. But I always think, why not ask? Why always ask for the discount? It kind of annoys people after a while, but it's kind of good to do. I have a good friend. He teaches a negotiation, and he will literally, when he gets bored, go buy a car. Not buy a car, but negotiate a car. He'll negotiate for 2 hours and walk out. He gets stuck in a city for an extra day because of a snowstorm and go negotiate for a car. He's never going to buy it. His goal was to see how bright. It's just practice for him. It's just practice.
That's awesome.
That's pretty insightful.
Yeah, but why not just stop by and do it? It's a practice. You're never going to see the person again. You're in Lubbock. Why not go to a dealership and say, how much is that truck? And I really don't want to pay that much. And see how far you can get them down. And you don't have to buy it. You're not signing any papers. You can say, I'll come back later. Yeah. But it's good practice in some ways. It's kind of, I think it's good to learn how to do that. Just making the ask is a really key skill. I think that's make the ask is kind of my theme for many people.
Well, you've done a tremendous amount of work on advocacy and everything. I mean, is that kind of like a good place to start for people? Like when they
advocacy about you persuade people. Advocacy about how you successfully influence people. It's all about having people adopt the ideas you have that are good ideas. It doesn't matter if you have an idea. If you can't get people to adopt it, it's gonna go nowhere. So if I want to build a new stadium, I got to sell the idea of a new stadium. If I want to get a new weight room, I got to sell the idea of a new weight room. It's all about, if you will, sales. But most of the internal inside organization is what I'm most interested in. Politicians have to advocate for their ideas. Public interest groups have to advocate for their ideas. Athletics has to advocate as well. You got to advocate for real estate on a campus. You got to for budget. The AD's job is to advocate for the athletics in the university as a whole. But coaches have to advocate with other coaches, with the AD, and with players. And players certainly have to advocate for themselves as well as for the sport sometimes. So it's all about how do I influence somebody to buy in one of my ideas? How do I get them to adopt an idea? And the way I teach it, there's a whole bunch of skills involved. One is to make sure people understand what you're talking about, communicating clearly. One is to make sure people want to listen to you. Well, it was Yeats, a poet, Irish poet, one time said, "Well, how do you tell the dancer from the dance? Are you the right person to present the idea? Why would I want to listen to you?" So it's all about building credibility. Then you got to get partners, get people to want to be part of your team, if that makes sense, to sell that idea. Then you got to kind of pre-sell and get people involved in your idea. And then you got to actually persuade them. And so there's kind of a five-step sequence I use, generally speaking. And it works almost every time. But advocacy is a really core belief in my life because it's all about getting people to adopt the things you have in mind. I assume goodwill, good ethics, okay? Yeah. But you know, you're a strength coach. How do you convince somebody to put that extra hour in? Not by threatening them. Threats don't go very far, but how do you convince them to put that extra time in? How do you convince them to go to bed early before a practice or a game? How do you convince those things? How do you convince people to eat right? That's all part of life every day. Parents have to influence their kids. Husbands have to influence wife and vice versa. It's all about influence. It's what coaching really is about, advocacy, when you think about. Most coaches can't force anything nowadays. They got to persuade.
Yeah, absolutely. Where do you think most people kind of fall short? Is it, you know, maybe near the beginning, like, you know, if they have like a great idea and, reality hits them, it's going to take work. They got to go through the steps and they fall short? Or is it the grind of it?
I think some people fall short of that. I think some people think that people adopt their idea. It's a good idea. People can see it automatically. I don't know how many people I've run into in companies, for example, say, you know, I had that idea 4 years ago. No one listened to me. You know, she used to work for me. Now she's my boss. It's not fair. They kind of assume ideas by themselves sell themselves. And that's only the first step. You have to have a good idea. But you also got to be able to sell this idea. And a lot of people just don't get that. They think, I write the report, it's adopted. CEOs, I make the announcement, it's happening. No, it isn't. You got to get people to buy into your announcement. And the mistake is a lot of people don't know how or don't think it's important to make the pitch at the same time. then the idea is obvious. That's one challenge. Another challenge is they're not ready for resistance. So, you know, public speaking, great skill. Most people in classes learn how to be eloquent in public speaking classes. It's okay. But we did research years ago that found it's not how eloquent it matters. It's how well you answer people's questions and challenges. I can do a sparkling presentation. You ask me a question, I can't answer it. You raise an objection, I fumble that too. It oftentimes becomes a feeding frenzy that stumped the chump. On the end, I answer your question brilliantly. I respond to your objection even better. You go, this guy knows his stuff. So we don't expect, the idea is brilliant. We know it's a critical idea. It's a must idea. But we can't imagine why somebody had problems with this idea. And so we don't prep enough for that response. That's another issue that we have to deal with a lot of times. People think it's no brainer. We got to do it. It's obvious. And they can't imagine anyone coming back. So I always tell people, if you're making a presentation, you probably spend too much time on your slide deck and not enough time thinking about people's questions or objections. Because my experience has been a lot of people can present eloquently, but they can't handle questions. That's when they fall apart.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, just I was thinking as you were talking there, you can definitely lose credibility and, like you said, some momentum with people is if you can't handle a question and answer, you know. And I don't know, I've done this long enough now. I spend more time now thinking about, like you said, what kind of resistance or objections or like, how is this or why is this going to get shot down when we go into this meeting? So with that, let's just hypothetically say you're dealing with an AD or a boss and you want to go in there and sell him some idea. What would be some strategies or techniques or whatever that you, how would you get that person to one? Because what I've seen, you said it earlier, they don't listen to you. Like within about 2 to 3 minutes, they're listening. And then if it's not something, they're checked out and you can see it in their eyes. They're there watching you, but you've lost them. You've not connected with them. You haven't caught their attention and they're done. So because I know like a lot of times that like at a big school like Texas, there's so many financial pressures and problems they're dealing with. They're always going to be like, well, how much is it going to cost? Right. So, but how would you, to our listeners, how would you navigate and give people advice on that?
One is brevity matters.
Right.
There's a wonderful thing in Hollywood called a log line. Every movie has a 1 or 2 sentence description in the entire movie. It's really hard to do. Take one movie and it's a 2-hour movie and you have to write 1 sentence that describes the entire movie. I always tell students, imagine drawing a billboard of your idea. One picture, no more than 7 words. So one thing when you're dealing with decision makers, brevity matters. But when you walk in the room, what do you want to do? Number one, you want to create a problem in their minds. People respond to needs. If there's a problem, I'll do something. If there's no problem, why adopt anything, right? So I always teach this as the why now question. Why should we do this right now? Why can't we wait? Mm-hmm. So you got to tell the AD, we got to do this right now because it's a big problem right now. Because if we push it down the road for 2 years, we're not going to do anything about it. But the why now is important. And that's the old-fashioned SWOT analysis we have in marketing, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Then you offer your proposal. Now, a big mistake people make sometimes is they present their proposal first. Here's what I want to do. And the boss says, we can't afford that. First, you create a problem. Then you recommend a solution.
That's so good.
Your doctor never recommends treatment until she recommends describes your malady. You don't go to your doctor. She doesn't say, I want to cut you open. She says, you got a weird growth in your skin. I want to biopsy it. Go for it. Always create the problem in people's minds before you recommend a solution. Because otherwise they're going to knock the solution, not even listen to your primary. Say, hey, let me explain why. Hold on, let me explain why. Always walk in and say, we have an issue right now that's a burning issue right now we got to deal with. And they'll say, you're right. And I say, I have a solution to it. But then what you got to do is show people benefits. One of the most important concepts in influence is called the "with it" question. What's in it for them? People got to see there's something in it for them. Not what's in it for you, but what's in it for them. We oftentimes start what we want, not what the other person would want. And then you got to handle objections. And last thing, and this is kind of interesting research, Donnie, that we've discovered this in the last 20 years. People fear regret more than excited by opportunity. Missing out is a deep fear. So companies buy other companies, not because they want the company, but they want to make sure no competitor gets the company.
You know,
Austin Real Estate. I wish I had. I should have bought that property years ago. Now I can't afford to look at it. Last couple of years, I should have sold. Now I can't sell. people are much more afraid of losing out than excited about getting. So you always answer to your boss, we don't have to do this, boss. We don't have to do this. But if we don't do it, let me tell you what's going to happen. Let me tell you what's going to go wrong if we don't do it. That's what gives them nightmares at nighttime. We should have done it. I didn't do it. I'm going to be in trouble because I didn't do it.
I've never heard that about regret.
But regret drives everyone. Regrets.
That is true.
You know, everyone has regrets. I should have married that person. I should have gone to that school. I should have taken that job. And people live to some extent in life thinking about regrets. And I don't want to think, if I don't do this, I won't get a second chance. Makes
you,
people
you
do
know,
it.
You made me, okay, for, I got to, hold on, Joe. He said something earlier. It's kind of resonating. You said something in our here at the beginning of the show, and what I've seen, to your point, is if you can find a way to take your ideas and let it become their ideas. But, like, how do you do that, though? Like,
let me give you a couple ways. One is, I always say, don't ask people questions. Ask for their advice instead. Present the problem. Let them solve it. Actually, what leaders do is leaders define problems. They don't define solutions. Leaders create problems. And they really honestly don't care about the solution with the reason of ethics and law and so on like that. They want the problem solved. So your AD says, we need to get better at this. He or she doesn't really care how you do it within reason of those things, right? They define the problem. Every new AD comes with a new set of problems.
Every time.
And what happens, they define the problems. So I ask companies, for example, are you a market share company or a margin company? Both of them, but you can't be both at the same time. One guy comes and says, we got to get more customers. Next person says, we got to make sure our customers are profitable. Different problems. They don't have a solution. Leaders don't focus on solutions. They focus on defining problems. And how you define the problem shapes everything. And footnote, creative people redefine things. They redefine the problem. You've always thought the problem's this. Now we think the problem's this. Good example. I'm a frequent flyer in American Airlines, for example. Okay. Years ago, you never fly American. I always fly American. You fly Southwest. Years ago, they treated you wonderfully and ignored me. Because the problem then was, how do we get new customers? Nowadays, airlines actually punish new customers, reward old customers, right? The problem changed from how do we get new customers to how do we keep our current customers? When you redefine the problem, new solutions come about. Like with kids, you and your wives talk about what's the problem with the kid there? What's the problem? They don't work hard enough. No, they don't have enough friends. No, they're too involved in computers. No, once you both agree on the problem, solution gets easy.
It's true,
But we spend too much time talking about solutions, not enough time talking about the problem. And a good leader understands their job is to find the problem, not to solve it.
Yeah, you kind of made me think of that picture of, like, sometimes leaders, you know, they climb the ladder, but sometimes the ladder is going, it's up against the wrong wall.
Exactly.
Right, and then you get to the top and go, like, why am I stuck up here?
Absolutely. You don't focus. I'm working on a project now. We're asking leaders what made them successful. What's the secret of success? I've been interested in this the last couple of years. I've been basically, how do people become successful? And I'm interested in the very small things they know other people don't know.
Yeah.
And one is choosing the right ladder. One is the ability to get off a ladder and go sideways sometimes. Lateral moves are sometimes very valuable. You may not move up. You may move side. You may actually move down sometimes. Because that gives you a chance to have exposed different things. I mean, you want to have a lot of experiences. One last thing, by the way, about leaders, one thing to remember also, and you go to your boss with an idea, and he says no, she says no. Always remember this. Ask them why they said no later on. Their answer will tell you how to persuade them next time.
Oh, that's so insightful.
Oh, wow.
That's
so in other words, I go to my boss and I want to do this, and she goes, nah, John, I could do it. Okay, I accept the other boss. A few weeks later, you know, you told me no. Why'd you say no? So let's suppose I want to bring you in as a speaker into that communication, Donnie, okay? Says, no, I'm not going to bring Donnie in. I say, why not? Well, Donnie's awful expensive, number one, okay? Number two, his slide decks are too kind of fancy for our people. And number three, honestly speaking, he talks too slowly for our students. Next time, what do I want to do? Get a faster talker, get cheaper and better slide decks. You just told me how to persuade you. When you ask why they're saying no, they'll tell you exactly how to persuade them next time. It's kind of a little secret most people don't know. Most people go, I'm not going to do it. I guess I'm not going to do it. I always ask, why do they say no? That tells you how to persuade them next time. It's a really neat trick.
I was at this conference in January, and it was coaches. It was the NSCA. It was a great conference. And this coach that I know, to your point, he came in with this big proposal. Like, it was... Number one, it was about 30 pages, so he was not There was no brevity.
No long line there.
And then he didn't, like you said, he didn't define, he didn't know how, why his boss said no. And so he just got shot down and never went back. He never circled back to figure out like why he didn't want to do it. And he never got it done.
Always go back, not necessarily the same conversation, but always go back and say, I appreciate you saying no and I understand that, but explain to me why you said no. And most people were glad to say the reasons why, and those reasons are how to persuade them. They just told you how to persuade them next time. By the way, one other thing about the coach in terms of that stuff, I always tell people when you're making a presentation, come on, let's say they're giving you 20 minutes at the conference to present. Come on, a 20-minute version, a 5-minute version. 5-minute version is almost always better. It takes more work to get the 5-minute version.
But, so much more.
If you're in a conference presentation, there are 5 people at the table, each of you has 10 minutes to talk. Somebody eats up too much of the time. No one wants to stay for your 10-minute presentation. They're going to love it if it's a 4-minute presentation instead. So it's really artistry to kind of take that length of time and cut it by 2/3 or 3/4. If I had to give the same presentation 1/4 the time, what would I say? It's a great way of figuring out what the key thing is. Not 30 pages, but if you had to summarize in 1 page, what would it be?
Yeah, I mean, that's like you said, you being an advocate and an influencer. If you go too long on all that, people check out so fast.
And
they start getting angry. People get angry.
Well, they go bored. And nowadays with media too, attention span has gone way down. People's attention span, because they're used to looking at websites now. Everything's quick nowadays. People can't even sit through a movie nowadays like they used to, unless it really keeps your attention over a period of time. It's just attention span's changing. I mean, I teach undergraduates. Having them read a book is not possible in many cases. I hate to say it. I like them to read a book, but they're not going to read a book. They don't even read a newspaper article sometimes. It's okay. I used to read deeply. They read broadly. So I might read an entire book to know something. They will go 50 different web pages for maybe 3 paragraphs a piece.
Yeah.
Just they take knowledge differently. And that's fine. It's just a way of learning stuff, right? I want to learn conditioning. I'm not going to take a manual and read the whole thing. I'm going to go to a bunch of YouTubes to watch. And I'll figure out what's going on across YouTube. So I'll see consistencies. Just different way of learning. But people don't have the attention span we'd like them to have sometimes.
No, there's a book I bought recently, and I've heard some people talk. It's called The Shallows.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book about what the internet's doing to our brains. And they go into this. The part of the book is like, because of the way the brain's wired and the way that the computer and the way we're looking at things on our phone now are so short that our brains are actually, we're getting where our attention, not only do we not pay attention, our attention span to like focus has gotten so bad. I know I've studied some of this myself with the way they used to train like ninja warriors. I've studied this before. They literally, what they would do, John, they would go and say, build this sandcastle that would take 3 to 4 hours to build this certain type of sandcastle. It wasn't to make this masterpiece. It was for them to learn to focus on one task for that length of time.
Interesting. That's fascinating.
And I wonder if in the future, if this is going to be something that may, you know, have things come back around. We have to learn how to focus down the road. So anyway,
well, I mean, I personally try. I mean, I force myself to read one reasonably long article every day. And it's really hard to do.
It's
really hard to do. I
find
every excuse not to, but I simply say I'm going to read a New Yorker article or a magazine article. I'm going to read one chapter and I'm not going to get up till I finish it. And it's really hard to do. I'm a big reader. I love books. I love reading stuff. But it's much harder now than it used to be. Because I'm so used to going to the web for everything, just reading a paragraph or two and being done with it. We're a resilient species, though. Don't worry. We're cockroaches. We will survive. And we'll just process data differently in some ways. And kids in college now, they're learning. They're learning a different way than I learned. But they're my social security anyway. I need them to learn well. And whatever works for them works for me.
Yeah. Is there almost, how do I say this, a hang up with some of that? We know where... We kind of spoke on how brevity can benefit you. Is there almost like too much brevity where they're kind of, you know, students there taking in information so sporadically and so quickly? You know, we just spoken, you know, be ready for the challenges and the questions. You know, if you only have wave tops prepared for, fighting for something you want, you know, is that where a lot of, you know, young professionals
get hung
up?
Yeah, I think it can be a problem. I think the ability, for example, answering questions, it's the follow-up question that matters.
Right.
Anyone can answer the first question. When I say, yeah, if that's true, then what about this? We judge people by the follow-ups. And so when I teach people how to do this, I talk about Supreme Court justices, for example. You get 36 seconds to talk before Supreme Court justices ask you a question. But it's never the first question that gets you. It's the third question. If that's true, sir, then if that's true, then what happens here? And the real experts are really good at the follow-up. And they're good at turning negatives into positives also. So a product's too small, actually it's portable. Product's too big, actually you can't lose it. They have this ability to take a negative and turn it into a positive. One thing I remember about questioning, for example, almost no one does something they know to be stupid. When people do things, they have generally a good reason for doing it. Now, looking back, they say it was stupid. But look, when they did it, a good reason. I mean, we're all teenagers once. I don't know about you guys, but I count myself lucky to be alive based upon my teenage years.
Exactly. For
every
sure.
dumb thing I did, though, at that moment, I had a reason. I was drunk. I was pissed at my parents. All my friends were doing. I had no idea what gravity inertial force was. So I just did it, right? Looking back, it was really dumb. And what I've discovered about really savvy people is they assume people always have a good reason for what they're doing. Once you figure that good reason out, everything makes sense. So if you're married, you've had arguments with your partner before. I said that because you did that, but I did that because you wanted this, but I wanted this because you did this. No one does something intentionally wrong. I'm very interested, do a lot of consulting on this kind of stuff and training on this, and fascinated by safety. No one comes to work planning to get hurt.
No.
When you debrief after an incident, they always have a good reason. Well, I have incredible balance. I was a gymnast in college. I have great balance. I didn't put my hard hat on because I didn't think I'd go to the job site today. In your business, people do weights and hurt themselves very easily, but they had a good reason. They didn't think it was that dangerous. They didn't understand physiology that well. They've done it 100 times before. And so if you really want to work effectively with people, you've always got to figure out their good reasons. That AD, you got to figure out her good reason, his good reason for saying no. If you can't figure out their good reason, you don't know how to work with them a period of time, because they're not saying no because they're dumb. They have a good reason. And figuring out people's good reasons is actually, when you talk about what makes people very successful, is figure out the good reasons. That's how couples work too, when you think about it. I mean, you want to go to Miami, your spouse wants to go on a cruise ship. Well, what are you going to do? You got to ask why. She wants food, drinking, going to lots of sites. You want to basically relax, do nothing on a beach. Where can you go instead? Maybe Vegas. All right? Once you understand the reasons why somebody wants something, it's easier to negotiate that. And the why behind the what is really an incredible thing. So we've been studying this for a couple years now. I've discovered that really successful people are great reads of people. You played football. You see a game differently than I see a game, mm-hmm. because you can read it differently. Kind of. You can read plays. I would never be. When you're playing football, you could read a play kind of without knowing you're not a read player. Yeah, a good pilot knows how to read clouds. A good sailor knows how to read the water, right? If you're a hunter, a military officer, you read weapons better than most of us do. Comes to leaders, reading people is the ultimate skill. And every successful person I've run into, self-made for sure, is a really good reader of people. So we've been asking the question for the last couple of years, what do they do to read people? What are the tricks they have? And we've actually done some really fun research on those tricks, because they all know how to read people better than most of us, because people matter more. And the big key thing is they assume people have good reasons for things. So the job is to figure out the good reason.
That's good.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, I'll use athletic performance as an example. You know, there's multiple departments within athletic performance, you know, nutrition, athletic training, strength. And every department within that group is, we're all advocating for ourselves to, you know, to try to elevate our department. And, you know, and I feel probably confident saying every school across the country is that way. You know, what ways do sometimes like maybe departments step on each other and maybe hurt each other in that process? And what are ways we can avoid, because we still need each other in one big group. If you know, you got to draw us on paper, it'd just be a big giant Venn diagram. And in the middle is everything we can do for the student athlete, you know?
I think what you do is keep reminding people of the goal. Keep reminding the goal. It's like with, you know, you and your partner having an argument. Hey, wait a minute, we're together. We're a couple. We don't like this work. We've been together for years. We have kids. We have a life together. Every so often you remind each other why that matters. And I think everyone gets their own little silo in business, like silos or departments, and we worry what's on our department, and we forget about the overarching mission. It's easy to worry about my academic department and not worry about people in engineering or education or the broad doing stuff. And I got to say, no, we want to create a student that's well-rounded. So I don't want them to take my class only. I want them to take a lot of different classes, so they get a lot of different experiences here. It's hard to do that sometimes. What's great for the overall group may not be great for you individually. Now, you don't want to be picked on and taken advantage of at the same time. You got to defend your territory, right? But you've got to understand the big picture, and keep reminding people of the big picture. And that's what leaders do, is they remind people the why they're there. Why, what's our mission? What are we trying to accomplish? And you do it in all sorts of ways. For example, I always like to say, I walk into a building, look at the lobby, and I can tell you what that business does if they're a good business. How you decorate communicates something, right? So if I go athletics, what do I see? Athletes who've gone professional, that'd be one message, okay? I see athletes who are working jobs once they graduate, that's a different message, right? I see pictures of coaches, that's a different thing. So how you decorate, tell me what matters. I was at USC a couple weeks ago in the SMI program, and we're in this conference center they have at USC for athletics. And they have all the Heisman winners on the walls. It's really cool. They have all the Heisman, great etchings, great stories behind them. All the guys won worldwide records this once. But there's a picture of this older guy, must be 70 years old as a day, right next to Heisman guy here, another big star here. This guy's in the picture, full-size picture. Who is he? He had gone to 680 games, never missed a game in something like 50 years at US, as a USC fan. I said, that's a really cool thing. You're celebrating fans along with athletics. I mean, most places, there's a message there, right? You walk in that room, you go, why him? Well, he didn't play sports. He was a mailman, postman, but he went to every game. His brother missed only two, okay, before he passed away, but he did 600 some games, never missed one. And that communicated something about USC athletics in a way I had not thought of before. Of course, every school celebrates their greatest players, Earl Campbell kind of things, right? But celebrating a fan equal to that is a different message in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. And so I always tell you how you decorate, communicate what matters. So I walk in the building, are you celebrating your function or are you celebrating what your function does for people also? That's another take home. There's a concept in customer service. No one wants your product. They want your product does for them. So is athletics about the student athlete or is it about entertainment? Or is it about building cohesion on a campus? That's the 80s question. What business am I in? Are we in the athletics business or are we in the school spirit business? Or are we in the donation business? By the way, not donations to athletics alone, but donations to the entire campus. Mm-hmm. If you fall in love with what your business does for people, it's always going to be more successful if you fall in love with what your business does. So are you in the entertainment business or in the hope business? What business are you in some ways, right? And I think when you remember that, you almost always get more cohesion. It's always good to come back in a meeting and say, hold on, what's our real business here? What's the real point of what we're doing? So we want to do weight training. We want good weight rooms, but we also want to keep people well fed in the search of what? Making these kids successful in what they want to do. And by the way, it also helps the entire campus in some ways. We're part of a campus too. And I think some athletic departments, the biggest silo is athletics versus non-athletics. And I think that's the worst thing that happens on some campuses. The silos within athletics are important, no question about it. But being apart from campus, the question is, when are you not part of campus anymore? I think our current AD does an incredibly good job. I don't know the man, but I think he's done a great job of kind of building a campus spirit around athletics in some ways. We've had previous athletic directors who were just irrelevant to the campus. And I think that's a really important thing. I'm not going to name names, but there are some people who worked hard to piss off the campus. This current guy seems really good at this stuff and kind of being a campus citizen as well, if that makes any sense. And so the value of athletics is more than simply the student athlete, which is important, don't get me wrong. The value is what athletics does for the entire community. And that's an equally valuable thing.
Yeah, no, that's good. I think, CDC's definitely done. He's got that ability to build bridges and extend olive branches.
I perceive that. Seems to be more involved in campus in some ways than some others. And, you got to give bad news to people, good news to people. But if you have the overarching goal, how do we make this a better experience for students? How do we build a sense of community? Mm-hmm. It's hard to disagree with those things.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful concept called God terms in the persuasion literature. If you hook your idea to a God term, it's hard to say no to.
I've heard you talk about this. Go into that a little bit.
God terms are words like quality, customer focus, sustainability.
This is good. If
you super glue your idea to a couple of God terms, it's hard for people to say no to it. So I might say in a meeting, as part of our quality industry, more customer focus, we need to do what I'm proposing. You think my idea is idiotic. You say, John, I like your idea. I say, wait, hate quality, hate customers. Which is it? Most of us have been in meetings before when people have literally picked our pockets metaphorically. They use a God term. We know we can't argue against it because the God term is so strong, right? God terms are, your kids do the same thing. Dad, don't you trust me? All right, God term. Who's going to say, I don't trust my kid, right?
Yeah.
So it's a God term. So you come back, well, we trust you. It's just your friends. That doesn't work, okay? They win with the word God term, trust. So every organization has these God terms. Maybe student athletes is God. Safety is God. Security is God term. Quality is God term. Schedule is God term. Every company, every organization has some God terms.
Safety.
Safety is a big one. And with all due respect to safety, and I deeply believe in safety, but enormous amounts of money spent on the name safety has nothing to do with safety whatsoever.
Very true.
So I work with one company, I won't name it, and the title is called Influencing for Safety. And they've never canceled a session. And they won't cancel a session because you cannot cancel a program because I'll read back this. You sure you want to cancel Influence for Safety? They go, no, we got to have it. I do it because I want no record of canceling anything with safety. And it was a funny exercise. The guy created it. It was the most burned out human being I've ever. He said, they will use this program for 100 years old if you want, John, because they never cancel anything with the word safety in it. By the way, how do you fight a God term? Competing God term. You always come up with competing God terms. So if you say it's part of our core industry to be more customer focused, I'll say, yeah, but you know, I think we have an ethical and moral and in fact a legal responsibility. Now the battle's pitched.
Oh yeah.
You always fight God term with the God term.
One up them.
So if you have younger kids, remember when they're teenagers, they say, don't you trust me? Think back to our conversation today and say, honey, we love you. They'll be so pissed. It'd be fun. They almost want to explode. Because they can't say, don't love me, right? Love versus trust fair. So like in manufacturing companies, there's generally, what, 7, 8 God terms, quality, schedule, cost, safety, security, environment, community. Can't do all those things. I can do something quickly, but it's going to be either very expensive or low quality. Safety and security are generally inversely related. If I make something completely safe, it can't be very secure. If I make it very secure, I can't make it very safe. So nightclubs, for example, there was a nightclub in Monterrey, Mexico about 10 years ago, caught on fire. A lot of people died. Very sad. Why? It was known as the most secure facility in Monterrey. Every door was sealed except for the main entrance, so no one could break in.
Mm-hmm.
So the fire happened between the main entrance and the people. It was secure but not safe.
Yeah.
So you always fight a God term with another God term. And God terms are really powerful when you're trying to persuade people. You can't do it, obviously. But if you hook to a couple God terms, it puts people in the awkward position where they can't say don't do it because they look like they're arguing against the God term. Who's going to argue against student athlete? That's a key word. By the way, student's a God term. Athletics isn't. All right? So student athletics is a different word than athletes. Athletes, rather. And your job, safety matters immensely. So you want somebody to do the weights safely. And if you want to get any piece of equipment, for safety reasons, we have to have this equipment.
Yeah, we're constantly talking about safety. I mean, that's why all the mental health stuff, because of the rate of suicide is rising, or we're more aware of it, I think, sometimes. But I think to your point, that's what's driving a lot of these initiatives right now.
And good for me. And it's God term. You cannot argue against the mental health of students. And you can't argue against students. It's a God term. Faculty is not a God term, by the way. Sadly, I'm not a God term, but students are a God term. And what's right for students is that we all should be around on campus. Everyone should wrap themselves around that. And I think your current AD is a good one at that.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some issues. And a couple of years ago, the stadium getting too packed too quickly, the entrance was a safety issue. It's built for security, right? But it came very close to a real disaster there. Because remember, they had one or two entrances for the kids coming in.
Right.
And there were too many kids coming in. So it was a case of security was being mattered more than safety. And that became a real issue in terms of how we're going to let people in the stadium now. And it was a good case of God terms because, yes, it was more secure. We had better crowd control, but too many people showed up at the same time.
I've never heard that, security and safety. That's so intriguing.
It's interesting. I mean, our stadium is a very – with the entrance we have, you can make an easy exit out of the stadium if something bad. Stadium security is an issue anyway everywhere you go. But I always worry about looking around, how safe am I here? It may be secure, but how safe? And vice versa. But both are God terms, and they compete against each other sometimes is the point. So if somebody uses a God term, always come back with a competing God term. Don't try to separate. Well, not really that way. Just come up with a competing God term.
A little higher, yeah.
It's a fun thing to do.
I had a quick little question for him too, Joe. I know we're kind of running out of time, but I heard somebody say something recently, John. You know, well, I really haven't found my voice yet, you know, and you know, over the years, I've heard that term so many times. Like, in basically what that is, in a big organization of 400 or 500 employees, right? And you're somewhere in the middle of the organization and you kind of get lost. And I think a lot of our listeners would probably be able to empathize with that. So how would you, if somebody say, man, I just can't find my voice, or I'm trying to find my voice in this organization, like what does that mean to you? And then like, what would you do to help them do that, you think?
I think voices, you want to be heard. Mm-hmm. You want to be heard. You want to be listened to.
That's it.
By the way, people don't need you to agree with them. They need you to understand them. So the mistake leaders make is they've got to always agree with people. You don't. Just so you understand them. People want understanding, right? If I know what you want, I can live with a disagreement. But I don't think you get in the first place, even your agreement's kind of cheap. So voice is having impact in some ways. And I always talk about building a personal brand in my classes. You want to build a reputation where somebody says, I need to listen to him about this. This is what I want to listen to. I listen to about facilities, training people, getting their muscles straight, doing it safely. I think of that your brand, right? Mm-hmm. So if you talk about that, it makes sense. If you start talking about nutrition, maybe a little bit. If you talk about football, you played football, a listener. You play your Marine Corps. You can talk about the military in a way you joke. You can't talk, okay? What happens? Branding matters. What your background makes you listen about something. So it's always figure out what people are going to listen to you about. And establishing a reputation for that thing. And you can establish a lot of different ways. For example, trust is one thing. Competency is one thing. How do I know what you're good at? When I bring your name up, what comes to mind right about? What's the word that comes with you over a period of time? Are you a trainer? Are you a Marine? Are you a football player? Are you a UT person? Are you the words that come to mind are critical. And you want to shape that. You want to shape that over a period of time. So they begin to think, you're the person I go to for that. When you start talking about something that doesn't match that, it gets more difficult sometimes. Like, why are you talking about that? So as you move up in an organization, you got to kind of change the brand you have, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You start off being a football player. Then you become a trainer. Then after you become a trainer, you may become assistant coach. After you become a coach, you may become an AD or you may become a broadcaster. Now, you can live off that. Broadcast, say, when I played football 20 years ago, when I was in the Marine Corps 15 years ago, they can get that. But your reputation changes, you move up. And you got to kind of texture your reputation. You got to kind of decide what you want to be seen as and build around that. Mm-hmm. And the way I do it is I talk about write down any three or four things you offer your organization. Just any three or four words come to mind. I'm creative. I'm outgoing. I'm smart. Then I'll say, now circle those that the organization deeply values. And you circle one or two of them. See, that's the first step. Figure out what's valued in the organization.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Then second, okay. I'll say, now, do me a favor. Of the things you circled, which ones are also scarce in the organization? Now, put a tech mark on those that are scarce. You offer things that are both scarce and valuable. All of us speak English. It's valuable, but not scarce. Speaking, I don't know, Kazakh is scarce, but not valuable in Austin, Texas. Now, in Houston, Kazakh language matters because of energy. Chevron's big investment is Kazakhstan. ExxonMobil's lead partner there. So in that city, Kazakh language is both scarce and valuable. In Austin, Kazakh language is scarce but not valuable. So you really want to figure out what those things are that are both scarce and valuable you offer. And typically about non-technical skills, because technical skills get you trapped at some point. So how do you move out of your job into a more leadership job is a real challenge for a lot of people. You're really good at the technical skill. Mm-hmm. But you got to expand that brand name out of that to a leadership skill, for example. And you have to work around the system. So you have military background. That gives you an extra credit point sometimes because you're in athletics now, but you're also the military. You're a Marine Corps officer at the same time. That's an interesting combination, right? Very few trainers at BET are also former Marine Corps officers. So people hear that go, that's interesting. I didn't know that about you. And Donnie, we always talk about you want people to discover your competencies and the two you want to focus on. One is what we call extraordinary competencies. These are ones that almost no one has, but everyone knows about. Olympic medals are extraordinary, right? One is called esoteric. Esoteric accomplishments are ones that almost no one knows about, but those few people know how special it is. And it's a very different set of competencies. It puts you in a very small club. So ex-military, you see a guy with his uniform on, ribbons, he has a baby blue ribbon with white stars on it, Medal of Honor. No one outside the military knows what that looks like. It's esoteric. You're an archery person and you got a couple Robin Hoods. No one knows what Robin Hood is. That's just big. It's when you split an arrow with another arrow, right? It's esoteric knowledge. And so when you have some esoteric knowledge, people know you, wow, they're special about that. Now, the key thing is you don't want to have to announce that. You want them to discover that about you.
Right.
So I was at a company a couple months ago in San Francisco going down the elevator with a big shot, one of the top leaders, and a new MBA person was with him. And we're in the elevator, and this MBA person starts talking to the janitor in a language. I kind of recognized the language a little bit, but I wasn't sure. Got off the elevator. The CEO guy says, "What language was that?" And the MBA says, "Filipino." "You speak Filipino?" "Yeah." "How'd you learn it?" "I did Peace Corps one back before I went my MBA." And then I said, and this was kind of a fun exercise, I said, "Well, you should be impressed by my name then." And the CEO looked at me kind of strange. And the MBA said, "You know, you're right. You're right about that." "Why?" "Daly City is the largest population of Filipinos in America. Best Filipino food. It's right outside San Francisco." Most people don't even know this. The MBA said, "You know this, I know this. We're kind of a special club. Most people have no idea. Daly City and Filipino food go together, right? My mother grew up in the Philippines. That's why I like Filipino food. But what happens is that was esoteric knowledge we shared in common." And the CEO said, "You guys mystify me. How you even know this stuff?" So extraordinary knowledge is great to have. Extraordinary accomplishments are great to have. But esoteric stuff is something that builds your brand even more. He's amazing. Let me tell you what he does, no one does. So one thing I always tell people if you want to be a CEO, develop a skill that surprises people. You do this and you do that is a great reputation builder. So the head of Goldman Sachs DJs electronic music once a month in a bar in New York City. What a weird combination, right? Larry Ellison, head of Oracle. Okay. Won American Cup twice. He's one of the best sailors in the world. How's that work? You got a UT player. What's his name? Justin Tucker. Great kicker. Probably the best kicker in the history of football, right? Opera major. Sings opera for fun. He's on opera benefits. Yeah. That's a weird combination. Football player, opera. You go, what an interesting person.
Fascinating, yeah.
So the way to build that reputation is to develop some skill that people go, that's interesting. Listen to him because of this. Listen to her because of this. Not only do they have a great brand name, they do something no one else does well, but they also have something that makes them particularly interesting. So I want to know more about that person.
That is tremendous career advice. Oh my gosh.
Fascinating. I'm really interested in what it is that some people, what makes some people more successful than other people.
No, you're right. I've seen people do that in a career that I've never heard it said like ISO, what'd you call it again? ISO?
Esoteric and extraordinary.
Yeah, I've never heard that compared like that. That is definitely, that's
you belong to a club, you belong to a private club. But the thing is, it's also, you know, everyone knows the Heisman Trophy is, right?
Right.
It's extraordinary. What's the Doak Walker? What's the
running back? Yeah, Doak Walker.
No one knows Doak Walker is. But those people know, go, he won Doak Walker 2 years in a row. Shit, he speaks my language. He's really good. All right, most people, it's esoteric thing, right? Marine Corps has esoteric stuff, okay? You know, you're another Marine talk about Okinawa. Yeah. And you know you belong because you're both stationed. You talk about the swimming pool in Okinawa, all right? People go, yeah, how do you know that? Well, guess what? I was stationed there. Well, I was too. You belong to this little club. So extraordinary stuff is neat, but most of us can't establish extraordinary things. Most of us not going to play Olympics. But all of us can go to something esoteric. And people go, you do that better than most. And I always tell people, get good at something that's going to surprise people. And once you get out of school, keep working at something. Get so good at something that says, you do that and you do that. How does that even work? Who's that football player played for the Ravens, is now a math professor at MIT? He was a lineman. I forget his name.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
I mean, what in the world? A football lineman, MIT math professor? That's a weird combination, right? And people go, that doesn't work in my mind. The fact that it doesn't work in my mind makes it interesting.
It does change the perception of
Absolutely.
How people see you. They see you so different. Yeah.
Absolutely. When you do something that people go, you did that and you did this, how does that work over a period of time? And if you think of most great people you know, they're good at one thing, but they also have something else that makes them interesting as well. I mean, your current AD, his taste in clothes is questionable sometimes, okay? But it's always orange stuff, right?
Yeah. He loves burnt orange.
And burnt orange. And he looks like, what the hell? How could you dress this way? But it's something, it's part of his brand to dress that way in some ways, right? And everyone kind of laughs that way when they see him because he's professional greeter at Walmart when he retires kind of guy, okay?
Right.
But that makes him different than some ADs who are most office persons, just the finance stuff. You expect that.
Yeah.
But he's so such good. A personable guy
that
people go, wow, that's neat. He does that. Our current president, Jay Hartzell, shows up at tennis matches and plays tennis with
kids. It's so cool.
What's the university president? He loves tennis, by the way, but he shows up. What's the president of university playing around a match with some athletes just for fun at the beginning? I play with anyone at the beginning or after a tennis match, right? Most people don't even know that about him.
But to your point, like, real quick, that makes you buy into people too.
Of course.
Like you like them more. you trust them more. It just comes with the territory.
A sweet person, what a sweet person. And there's something we talk about in the research about how to build trust. And you want to do little things proactively. It's called good faith in the trust research. You do something proactively nice that people don't expect you to do, and they go, what a sweet person. And that's to never be underestimated. That's being a sweet person is a great thing. And you don't have to do big things, just little things that people say, you know, he's such a nice guy. Mm-hmm. She's a sweet person. Because they do something different. So a friend of mine was a big star, four-star general, walking by the White House one day. He's in his uniform briefing the President of the United States at 2 o'clock. Staff Sergeant taking a picture of his wife and 3 kids. What's my friend do? He stops, says to the sergeant, you want me to take a picture of 5 of you? Oh, you're in the military. 4-star general, staff sergeant, they get your attention, right?
Oh, yeah.
It took my friend, what, a minute to take that picture? Probably created life memory.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Doesn't require that much to be distinctive in a positive way. But you got to be proactive about it, right? People notice when you do those little things. That's what I'm building your reputation when people say, great guy, great coach, also really nice guy. And leaders sometimes plan to demonstrate that niceness, but the genuineness does matter. And so I think that's one of those things like, he's so busy, he's so important, but he also remembers little things about people. He's just a nice guy.
I got a good story, and we'll let you kind of wrap up here in a second, Joe, but just one last story. To your point, my first year coaching at Colorado, I was 1994 and working crazy hours, John, and left the weight room late one night, was tired. And back then, you know, I was an intern, a little peon, and I had to park really far away from the weight room, so it was late at night. I'm walking down this hill and this car pulls up beside me and I look over and the gentleman inside goes, hey, can I give you a ride to your car? And it shook me at first and caught me off guard because it was Bill McCartney.
Wow.
He was our head football coach who everybody knew him. And he, you know, at the time, I mean, they'd won the national championship in like 1990. This is 94. Like the head coach is talking to me, the peon intern. Do you know, like, it changed how I perceived him from that day forward, the kindness of that. It literally took him, and when I got in the car with him, he was very like, how's your family? Like, how are you enjoying Colorado? It made me want to work harder for him.
Absolutely.
And that's just great leadership,
too. And it took him, what, maybe 3 minutes to drive you there?
If that, yeah.
But here's the thing, you still remember it. You still remember it 30 years later. And it was 3 minutes.
Right.
It's the notion of just proactiveness. We call positive discretionary behaviors. You do something positive you don't have to do, but people notice when you do it. And they go, what a sweet person. And in truth, to be honest with you, it gets manipulated sometimes. So big presence of companies, big elected officials, they send them to a little school to talk to kids for an hour. And people go, what a sweet guy. Okay. Or they give money to a charity. But they don't tell, but let people discover it over time. But being nice builds your credibility in some ways. And you remember that it's esoteric knowledge. I never knew that about him, but he does that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, John, as we're kind of wrapping up here, we always ask our guests at the end, what are your top 3 books, podcasts, articles, resources that you can't do without?
Oh, wow. There's so many of them. Top 3 books. There's so many books I read on a regular basis. I teach Machiavelli's The Prince every spring semester of my MBAs. It's one of the most published books in history. It's been everywhere. They do these studies where they look at what people read when they're famous people. The Prince can be about manipulation, but it's really an interesting book. It's about mergers and acquisitions. It's about influencing. It's about managing people. So, I mean, that's a classic I read sometimes. Podcasts. I actually like, believe it or not, C-SPAN has a book review podcast. There's a guy named Brian Lamb who created C-SPAN many years ago. And every Sunday he has something called Book Notes. And he interviews somebody who's just done a book, typically about politics or history. He loves history, especially presidential history. And so I've always liked Brian Lamb's podcasts. I love trivia stuff. I love I never knew that kind of stuff. And Bill Bryson, thus is one of my favorite writers. Bill Bryson actually is a U.S. guy who lives in England, okay? He writes these great nonfiction books. He bought a church in England years ago and said, now I want to turn this into a home. What rooms do I need? So a wonderful book called At Home. Each chapter is a history of one room. So I like books that kind of nonfiction, just that's interesting books. I love learning that's interesting stuff. I am a big magazine reader. I love The Economist magazine only because I learn a little bit, a lot of things each week. It's the only news magazine that lasts. So podcasts like your podcast, Donnie, this Con podcast. I listened to a couple of them before I came here. I'm going to keep listening to them.
Thank you.
I don't know, I know something about sports, but not as much as I should know about sports. But I listen to podcasts, interest when I learn about sports in a way you wouldn't learn if you watched ESPN. I think it's fascinating to learn kind of from the trenches as you're doing, basically. Yeah, yeah. And you have such a wide variety of people talking on these things that go, I never knew that. And I love the reaction of, never knew, that's interesting. And so I'll be honest, the podcast you guys do, I've started listening to, and I find just going back, you got what, 50 something now of them.
Yeah.
I can pick and choose one. I've downloaded them all, actually. I'm ready to listen to them all. But I think just, I love learning, that's interesting stuff. So anytime somebody tells me something to listen, I always listen to it once or twice. But I don't have one book or one podcast. There's so many of them.
I got one more fun question, and we'll be done. What's your favorite place to eat in Austin, John?
My home. My wife's cooking is amazing.
he got big points right there.
My wife's cooking is amazing. I like the original Mahdi's, for example, on Lake Austin Boulevard. I like kind of local places.
So when you go to Mahdi's, what do you order?
For breakfast, order a couple of tortillas with some eggs and make my own.
So good.
I like the old Cisco's that's now in
Muni. I've been there.
The Muni Cisco.
The butter, the biscuits with the honey. Joe.
Cisco's great. And they used to be on East Austin and stuff like that, but they're now in Muni Golf Course, the Cisco's.
I haven't been to that one.
I'm a big kind of East Coast diner fan. I like these small businesses that you get.
Yes.
I think you generally get better food. Sometimes you get sick, but I think you get better food. But I think you're all supporting entrepreneurship, and I just love that. And I'm not a big chain restaurant person. I mean, I know they're important, but give me a choice between a little diner on the side of the street and a Panera's or Popeye on the side. Take the little diner. Dirty's, for example. It's a great place. I just like going up there for that. I get a milkshake there. I get a milkshake at Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A has good milkshakes. But give them a choice to go to Dirty's simply because I want to support those kind of things. So you always find me at the little diner places instead. Somebody one time told me, he was actually a Marine Corps general. He said, every time I got transferred in my life, from the time I was a second lieutenant, I'd always find one kind of little town diner near the post, near the base. I go there for breakfast every day. He said, I learned so much about the community that way. And you don't, not at Denny's, but just go somewhere with a group and drink coffee and you just become part of that group for a couple of years. He says, I got the feel of the town that way. And because Marine Corps bases mostly are not in big cities. So you get the sense of community. He says, you know, I could go to a Denny's, I could go to the officers club, but I think going to the little diner for breakfast every morning on the way in. People kind of got to know me. And if there's a community issue when I became a colonel or one star, guess what? I could know they talked to me about stuff. They won't talk otherwise. So I always thought those little local places make my favorite thing. I'm always looking for places like
always
that.
Always learn something. Oh, yeah. So good.
Quick please. Little thing on that. Really, I think it's a cool story. So when I was stationed in Okinawa, or I was deployed there at the time, and a buddy of mine came into my room and was like, hey, you want to go get dinner? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. So we're on Camp Schwab. It's kind of north, a little middle of the island, and we go up to the northern city, Nago, and he knows where he's going. I have no idea where we are. And we park and then we start walking down this alleyway and I'm like, where are you taking me, man? And we go into this little restaurant, hole in the wall, kind of like you're talking about. I mean, the most authentic Japanese restaurant you could possibly go into, because the only people that could have known this was there, I mean, he kind of wandered into it one night and knew and remembered where it was at. But I mean, the only people that could know where it was at was the locals. And the only English speaking guys in there, we figure out a way to order food and it was fantastic. I was like, man, like, and it kind of stinks to this day. I couldn't find my way back, but that was awesome.
I always tell people in sales, pick one or two restaurants, go there regularly, tip well. When you need to get in last minute with a customer, client, they'll get you in. And you want the waiter to say, this guy, so Donnie's good. Great. This guy is Donnie great. You know, Donnie's one of my best friends. He comes here all the time. He's just a nice guy. I tell your customer that. Your customers love it. So it's always finding that one place or two places you go to. And it's good to get things that are tied that make you interesting in some way. So music, I'm not a big music fan, but if we go to music, Skylark Lounge on Airport Boulevard, almost no one even knows it. It's a music place, but only locals go there, okay? And they get nothing fancy there. But you find those little places, you take people there, they think they get the authentic experience. And it's nice when people greet you when you walk in. Hey, John, how you doing? And I can say, a regular. I can order for you. And I think people are impressed, again, managing your impression, people impressed when you seem to know local. You seem like a normal person as opposed to a very fancy restaurant. You know it's good, and it's authentic food in one case where you're drinking, but it's knowing that no one knows that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And think, wow, you know the city inside and out. And that's the thing I think, you know, I always talk about Austin changing. I've been here a long time, almost 50 years. And I kind of miss some of the places I grew up with here, so to speak, because they were kind of quirky places that most people said, what are you going there? But it was fine.
Yeah.
D.C., I still go to one place in D.C. It's a little Greek restaurant. When I was in high school, I went there every day for lunch. And the family, they can't cook to this day. If I won the lottery, I'm saying the kids to culinary, great grandkids to culinary school.
Yeah,
but they know me by name, and I walk in maybe three times a year now, and they still remember me, and something like that. And we talk about the grandfather passed away. And you feel like you belong to the community that way. So I'm really kind of, in terms of eating places, that's my kind of favorite thing. Find those little niche places that have great food, but also great company. And also you're supporting something which I deeply believe in is entrepreneurship. I think people put their hopes and dreams in places like that. And you all support the hopes and dreams. And nothing against chain restaurants. And many of them are franchise where people hopes and dreams. But I'm just kind of I'm a small town diner kind of place at my personality. You know, and then I like it where they say, you forgot your wallet, don't worry, you pay us next time. I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say that Panera's not going to say that Popeyes, but they'll say that those places. I think that's kind of a compliment when you know them so well, they say. Or they'll make you a special meal. I know exactly what I want my steak and cheese at this Greek place in Washington, D.C. area. And they'll still make my steak and cheese. And I know what I like. I'd hate mayonnaise with a passion. They never put mayo on my, they say, they joke, we put a bottle of mayonnaise in there. They'll joke about it. I'll laugh. They know I hate mayonnaise. They don't have it, a mayonnaise. And that's just kind of I like that. I think you support those things. Economic is good, but you also get great conversation in those places. You can spend an hour talking to them about their history.
For sure. For sure.
Well, that's it. If any of our listeners want to reach out, where can they?
Email me, daily@austin.utexas.edu.
There it is. Well, Dr. Daly, Dr. John, call you John.
Call me John.
Our friend. It has been an absolute pleasure. And man, I know I've learned a lot today, and that's why I was a little selfishly wanting to get you in here so I can learn from you too. But thank you so much.
My pleasure. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thanks for the opportunity. Right. I love talking about this stuff. I could go on for a whole semester, come and think of it. 40 hours. We only got 1 hour.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate it very much.
Well, that's it for the team behind the team. If you have not followed John Daly, look him up, read his stuff. He's got some videos out there. You will be amazed and learn so much. So, John, thank you so much. Big Joe, that's it for today. Hey, we'll catch you on the next episode of the Team Behind the Team podcast. And we'll see you soon. Hook 'em.
Hook 'em.
Thanks so much for tuning in and listening to this episode of the Team Behind the Team podcast. For future episodes, go to iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Stitcher. We definitely want to keep having great guests on the show and great content. So if you have a moment, please go to iTunes, leave a rating and review, and let us know how we're doing. I'm Donnie Mabe, and thanks so much for tuning in.